This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars, episode 48, was recorded on August 20th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. All-Star Dr. Pippa Malmgren is back with us today, and this episode of Macro Voices All-Stars is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, the only podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing. And right now, they're offering Macro Voices listeners a free book called The Many Flavors of Trend Following. I'll tell you how to claim it at the end of this episode. Pippa, when we had you and your dad on the program recently, I thought it was very interesting. It seems like he's kind of on the side of maybe things in the economy are not looking so good. Stock market might be in real trouble here. That was not your view. Now, since then, we've had quite a few things happen that have led a lot of people to say, okay, this is the big one. You know, here it comes. This is going to be the fall where, you know, the high is in August and it's all downhill from there. And it's 1929 before you know it. And what's going to happen is the U.S. dollar is appreciating. That's going to cause all kinds of havoc. The stock market's going to crash. Sky is falling. World's coming to an end. You don't see it that way, even though your dad does, or at least he sees some of the arguments on that side. Why don't you give us the big picture? And meanwhile, we are also doing a special, which will air after this airs, with Danielle DiMartino Booth and Peter Bookvar, who are debating whether or not we're headed toward negative interest rates in the United States. And certainly, yield curve inverting, you know, that's a recession signal. There seems to be a lot of things that a lot of people are interpreting is this is it. It's been 10 years since the great financial crisis. Now comes the first recession, the one that maybe is the trigger to bring on an even larger crisis than 2008. You're not buying that story. How come?
Well, and I haven't bought it now, certainly over the roughly the last 6 years when it has come back with ever more popularity. And yet still, this is not what has happened. So it's not necessarily a news story, but the frenzy about things seems to be intensifying. And that's partly because of new events like the threat that China might actually sell its very significant holdings of U.S. treasuries. And so I just kind of like to address each of these things. If we start with the Treasury story, the bottom line is every pension fund in the United States pretty much is massively underfunded. And now with interest rates going negative, they can't get those returns. So what is the end result? Two things. They're going to have to buy equities, and that will be supportive of the equity market because they can't get the returns in the debt market. And second, even if China were to sell everything, that means every U.S. pension fund would have the opportunity to buy. And if the yields went up because of the Chinese selling, they would say, excellent, now I can get a higher return than I would otherwise in the debt market. And the regulator pressure on the pensions to own more quote unquote safe assets, you know, which basically means the treasuries of our government, that pressure remains the same, if not intensifies. So what we end up with potentially is just a transfer of ownership from China or foreign entities to U.S. domestic entities. Now, you could have a big conversation about, is it better for grandma if the pension fund is funded by her or an American citizens or funded by foreigners? And that gets you into the whole current account deficit story. And America continues to have a current account deficit problem. But when things get bad, what do people buy? They still buy the U.S. dollar. Hence the story of the U.S. dollar going up in value. So I think there's a whole bunch of factors that may have circular outcomes that people haven't entirely thought through on that front. The other thing is that what I find is that, you know, I've spent many years on a trading floor and I loved being on a trading floor. I love the energy. I love the deal flow. I love the news and the way everybody talks. But now I've been off a trading floor for quite a long time and not only working in the White House, but, you know, now I'm running a manufacturing enterprise. I actually make robotics. And what I think people on trading floors are not understanding is that entirely new economies, new sectors of the economy are coming to life, and they're going to create new GDP on an epic scale. For example, virtual reality. And that'll be something that everybody laughs at. They go, oh, don't be ridiculous. Virtual reality. Yeah, but this is kind of what people said about, you know, website developers 20 years ago. And yet now it's a profession. It's a sector of the economy. Every other sector of the economy depends on website development. Well, virtual reality is similar. It's extraordinary, the advances being made and their use, for example, with burn victims. Because if you believe that you're in the Arctic and it's freezing cold, your body responds as if you are in a cold environment and your burn heals much faster than it would otherwise. The displacement of medical treatments and drugs by VR alone is just a massive coming sector in the economy. So when people say, oh my God, market conditions look like we're going to fall into 1929, what they consistently underestimate is all the new innovation. And again, in my space, which is drones, you know, aerial robotic tools for industry, I see myself that so many companies haven't even begun to think about applying these new technologies. They're, you know, full of people who are nervous about tech. They're in their 40s, their 50s, their 60s. They're like, oh, you know, I don't really understand it. Therefore, I'm not using it. Yeah, but the minute somebody in the company starts to use it, you watch the margins expand. You watch the revenue flows dramatically increase. And since I can see how few companies are intelligently deploying the newest technologies, I can see that the scope for huge improvement in margins and equity valuations is extraordinary. But you don't really see that if you're sitting on a trading room floor, if you're looking at the world strictly through the lens of a financial investor. And on top of that, things like, you know, this week, people have cited the fall in U.S. industrial production and manufacturing orders being down. But again, when I talk to real clients in the real world, what they're saying is, I'm so overwhelmed by the degree of choice, I don't even know what to buy anymore. And I'm terrified of buying some new technology that's completely outmoded in a week. So rather than make a mistake, I'm now taking time to study and I'm really diving into the subject. So their order book, yes, it's down. But does this mean that there's a trend of reduction of growth and productivity in the economy? No. What it means is that they are gearing up to make some serious commitments. And I just think we might confuse those two things unnecessarily. Those are some of the examples that I have in my mind when I look at the, you know, at the news and the landscape, and I see everybody going, you know, run, we're about to have a collapse. And by the way, even if I'm dead wrong, if we're about to have another financial crisis, well, the fact is the last one got resolved incredibly quickly and decisively and resulted in the biggest bailout in modern history. And the end result was equity holders ended up making a fortune if they invested in it. And frankly, we've had basically a decade of ever increasing asset prices on an extraordinary pace and scale. So if it happens again, I would call that potentially a very investable event again. And then people say, well, but governments won't be able to bail out or they won't bail out in the same way. Well, it's also true that the crisis won't happen in the same way. The crisis never happens in an identical way. It always happens in a somewhat different way, which then opens up all kinds of possibilities. And I guess this is where my dad and I tend to disagree. His view is that because of Donald Trump in the White House and his lack of ability to have any camaraderie with other governments means that there's no capacity for governments to band together to come up with a solution. My view is if it's bad enough, they'll always find a way. So even your worst case scenario is a survivable event. And I would also say, if we go back to 1929 and really study our history, lots of questions about whether the pain needed to have lasted as long as it did. And maybe part of what caused the prolonged nature of that recession was government policy itself, and need not be repeated, and could have been, like many other corrections, very short-lived. But we made a lot of mistakes at that time. So those are many of the reasons that I'm feeling a lot more relaxed about where we're going in terms of GDP and growth projections, but also asset valuations.
Well, Pippa, I really want to ask a few more questions, because I know that you are, number one, an incredibly good big picture thinker. And number two, your geopolitical background allows you to look beyond just market function and look at the bigger social picture. And I understand your arguments in the immediate time frame, but it seems to me, as you said, pensions are being forced into equities. There's not enough yield for them to come anywhere close to meeting their obligations if they just invest in safe fixed income. So they are reaching into equities, and they have to, but it's still not going to be enough. By almost any measure, we're going to have some kind of pension crisis where we can't keep all of the promises that have made as the baby boomer generation ages. And I think that at some point, what it sets up is, I think, what you described as a different flavor of crisis. We get to something which is financial in its motivators and its drivers, but it's not so much of a market crisis. It's more of a true social crisis where you realize, hey, these pensions, a lot of them are going to go broke, and there's not enough backstopping. There's not, the government doesn't really have the ability to backstop all these things. And you get to a social crisis, which I think is going to lead to a lot more pressure for modern monetary theory and socialism and government bailouts and so forth, which I think are, it's very understandable to see why people would want those things. But to my thinking, it comes at a time when, in my opinion, the U.S. dollar's stranglehold on reserve currency status is weakening. And the U.S. ability to finance bailouts and deficit spending is, I think, going to come under serious pressure in coming years. So not in the next year or so, but 4 or 5 years down the road, aren't we headed for a really big social crisis when the pension system fails?
So here is the shocking answer to the question. This is the way we resolve this, is people go back to work. It's really simple. People register that their plan, which was, let's say, to retire at 55 and live till 100 and never work again, they're now realizing this isn't going to happen. It doesn't, they don't have enough. And even if they planned correctly and they had enough, the rise in inflation or the real cost of living means there isn't enough. So they look around and they go, well, I got to go back to work. And actually, this is a great thing, because all of this, you know, human capital comes back into the economy and does productive things. And so I think, yes, the crisis is the realization that this vision of my future isn't going to happen. And they go back to work and they might grump about that. But the reality is, most people, if they have any choices, and I'll come to those who don't, because that's a different question. But for those who have choices, I mean, most people I know who are in their 50s and 60s and 70s, frankly, even people in their 80s, like my dad, who's still working, they're all actually quite excited to be, you know, working with something interesting that they're working on. And they're very much like the millennials and the Gen Zers. The older crowd, the boomers, are learning how to run a portfolio life where they work for several employers in different capacities. And some of it's a little entrepreneurial and risk-taking. Some of it is advising on something where they're a long-standing expert. It's, you know, like tying their shoelaces. They know how to do it so easily. And the employer would rather have a part-time, reliable older person than someone they have to train up and have full-time on the payroll. And this is even truer still when it comes to vocational skills. And there's such a shortage of vocational skills and life experience that I think the market demand for these older folks is actually quite significant. And every startup needs to say, I have someone who's a little bit older who's sitting on my advisory board or my board. And so even that creates a demand. So I think the simple solution is, yes, the structures don't last. The structures are broke. I mean, even the pension benefit guarantee fund is set to go bust in 2025, which is the backstop for all the pensions. So then everybody goes, well, we can't fulfill the promise that we made. Now, what are people going to do? Is it going to be the French Revolution? Are they going to, you know, storm Congress? It's really kind of hard to imagine a whole bunch of folks in their 50s, 60s, and 70s with their pitchforks taking to Congress. I mean, I suppose it's possible, but I think much more likely is they're going to go find a couple of interesting portfolio jobs. And actually, this improves GDP. It raises their income. In fact, they start to think about spending again because they go, oh, you know, maybe I can do this another 20 years. And look, medical advances in every category of medicine and health is meaning that they are able to work for much longer, more productive lives. So then the big question mark is the people who don't have these choices, who don't have skills, who don't have a network and don't have a resume. And those folks, now we got a different problem. And these are the ones that they're problematic, and whether they're 20 or whether they're 80, these are the people we talk about who aren't sufficiently skilled to even work at a McDonald's or a Walmart. Now, this category is a serious issue, and there's a massive social responsibility that we all have to decide how are we going to manage these people who fall through the cracks of the society. But even that is increasingly addressed by all kinds of entrepreneurship and innovation that's happening in education, corporations training people from scratch instead of only hiring college graduates. And I'm not saying that that's enough to catch 100% of the vulnerable people in this category, but I am saying our capacity to address this is vastly greater than it's ever been before in history. And it will be our own darn fault if we don't do it. It's not that it can't be done. You know, this is not like the Industrial Revolution where, you know, you end up with children and the elderly being completely discarded by the society. And you know, this is not that world. We live in a very different time and space where technology and public consciousness, I think, will be able to address a lot of this. And what it can't, this is the question about what is it the state is responsible for. So if the state says, you know what, we can't actually fulfill these pension promises, which, by the way, they'll never say out loud, they'll find 5 million ways to not fulfill the promise and yet not say that they're not fulfilling it. But what will they be obliged to do? They will be obliged to look after the people who are the truly, truly vulnerable. And then that's an interesting question. What proportion of the population over the age of, say, 55 are going to be in that truly vulnerable, cannot help themselves no matter how hard they try category versus the ones who, by hook or by crook, will be able to find an alternative way of generating revenue, income, and living their lives. So will the social contract be broken? For sure. Is it impossible to resolve that contractual break? Absolutely not. It's easy to resolve it. The ones who can go back to work will, and the ones who can't, they are the ones that need our attention. So that's one way of thinking about how this gets addressed.
I want to probe a little bit deeper on the latter group that can't make the transition, because it seems to me that we could be headed toward an intergenerational conflict where retiring boomers look at this and say, we have to, you know, I paid into this Social Security system. Promises were made to me that I'm counting on. My ability to live in, other than in poverty on a street corner under a bridge someplace is dependent on, you know, we got to bail out this system. And meanwhile, millennials and Gen Z are saying, wait a minute, we studied this in history class way back in 1975 when people still watched broadcast television. Your 60 Minutes television show told you it was guaranteed that Social Security would go broke by 2025 if you didn't fix it. And you didn't fix it. It's your fault. Don't put this on us. You're not going to tax us to bail anything out. This is your problem. You didn't save. Tough luck. It's easy to understand why people on both sides of that would feel those things. But what do we do with elderly people who can't support themselves at that point?
So again, this is really interesting that you put it in those terms, because millennials are remarkably socially conscious and they are interested in this question of how do you make money off of an aging society? And you see lots of millennials setting up businesses that are designed to serve the interests of the elderly. So they're not willing to write the check for the elderly to live on the lifestyle they had intended, but they are willing to create businesses that serve their interests. So, you know, it's a different way of doing these things. The other thing is, if we, again, step back from this, we live in a world now where we do have the ability to create sovereign cryptocurrencies. And you and I have talked about this before, but every country pretty much has said we intend to create a national sovereign cryptocurrency. China has said it. The European Union has said it. The Americans are definitely looking at it. Now, what does that mean? That means you can create a new currency system literally at a keystroke. Now, can you issue scrip or money of some description to those people? Yeah, you absolutely can. Now, traditional monetary policy theorists will be horrified and say, oh my God, this is going to be inflationary. And I say, yeah, yes, in theory, but in practice, how do you even count the money supply when you can double it or have it with a single keystroke? How do you even see? It's a very old notion of how we comprehend monetary policy. How many pieces of paper or pieces of coins are circulating in the economy? And then we realized back in the late 60s, early 70s, that there were these things, you know, sort of bank savings plans that were effectively creating new forms of money. They were kind of the early asset management structures. And so we went, oh, we better include that in what we count. And so we kept naming monetary policy quantities after new letters, right? And there was, you know, M3 and M4. And then we kind of lost count and we MZ or MZ, as the Americans would say. The reality is, if you really have a terrible problem and you got to pay for it, you can create money out of absolutely nothing using the creation of a cryptocurrency scheme. And when you're held to account, how much money did you release in the economy? Well, you can see exactly, and you can also make it disappear if you want. You don't have the same constraints as you used to have with a physical currency system. And I have argued for many years now that governments want to convert from physical currency systems to completely electronic crypto-based systems, because then they can see every transaction. It won't be possible to have a transaction that they aren't aware of. And that makes it easier to tax transactions at the point at which they occur, but also to manage the monetary system, because you can move the money supply like whenever you feel like it, for however long you feel like it. So I think this is a technology answer to the debt problem. And that's what I argued in my first book, Signals, was we can't underestimate that governments will just love to get out of the problem by moving away from the old system. Don't think of yourself being stuck in the existing monetary system. One way you get rid of the problem is you just step out of it and build a new one, which today is super easy.
Well, Pippa, I can't thank you enough for another fantastic interview. We look forward to getting you back on in a month or so for another update. Today's All-Stars episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. This podcast, which I highly recommend, is delivered to you by some of the world's leading practitioners and gives you an unprecedented insight into the world of trend following and other rules-based investment strategies, which have delivered outstanding returns for many decades. So if you want a different perspective on how to invest in today's markets, without emotions and without predictions, go to toptradersunplugged.com/macro, where right now you can claim a free copy of the many flavors of trend following. Check them out. You'll be glad you did. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.